Wayne Harding.
Well, Mr. Chairman, comrades and friends, we're talking tonight about economics, and any of you who have seen the advertisements will know that we are asking you to get acquainted with Marxian economics. Now, two questions have to be dealt with here. First of all, why do we think that workers ought to study economics at all? And the answer is that if workers don't get some understanding of economics, that is the way capitalism works, the system in which they live, they will go on making the same sort of mistakes that they have made in the past. But the second and more serious question that we've got to answer, there are people who say, yes, all right, workers should understand something about prices and wages and unemployment and machinery and things like this. But why on earth do you want to study Marx, who died nearly 100 years ago, and who therefore cannot possibly have been familiar with the sort of things that go on in the modern world? They will say he died a long time ago, all sorts of changes have taken place since then, all sorts of new economists have come along who, by definition, they will say, the later economists must obviously have a better understanding of what is happening than Marx could possibly have had, in view of the fact that Marx died in 1883. They will say, in fact, as they do, that
well, just discontinue for a moment, friends, while we settle ourselves down. Sorry you were late.
Yes, I was explaining why we think workers should have some understanding of economics and why we think they should study Marx. And as I was saying just a few moments ago, Marx died a long while ago. A lot of economists have come along since, and it may seem a very powerful argument for our opponents to say these modern economists, who incidentally are quite numerous, must have a better understanding of what's happening at the present time than Marx did, who died so long ago. They will say, in fact, that you can hear this quite often, you get hold of students at universities studying economics, and they will tell you that all of the economists, which is true with one or two exceptions, all of the economists say Marx is out of date, you don't need to worry about him, sheer waste of time and all the rest of it. From which they would conclude that if we say study Marx, so we're just being pig-headed, you know, we're sort of carrying a torch for Marx and that there's nothing more to it than this. Well, right, it's a fair question. But we are not at all convinced by this objection to studying Marx. And without spending a lot of time on going over a lot of economists, the man who is supposed to have taken the place of Marx and pushed Marx into the background was the late J.M. Keynes. All of the political parties now, except the Socialist Party of Great Britain, are more or less consciously followers of Keynes. All the governments that we've had in this country since the end of the war, the majority of members of the cabinets have been followers of Keynes. And this is a legitimate point to take up. If the modern economists, who are almost all of them Keynesians, know more about capitalism than Marx did, just look at one thing. Marx said that capitalism, and he based this on a study of what was going on in this country in the 19th century, he said capitalism goes through phases. It goes through a phase of expansion, a boom, a crisis, a depression, stagnation, and it goes round and round and round like this. Keynes came along and said, it doesn't matter what happened in the past, this is finished. We now know, said Keynes, and all the Keynesians agree with him, we now know how we can get rid of all this. There will be no more of this stop-go, this trade cycle. We are going to have full employment. We are going to have a comparatively stable price level, and we are going to have steady expansion. Keynes claimed a lot of other things too. Well, as I say, you don't want to elaborate this too much, but simply to ask yourself the question, what on earth is happening at the present time? Here is all the Keynesian stuff gone wrong. That they have not had a stable price level. Prices are five times what they were in 1938. They have not had continuous rapid expansion. For the last two or three years, they've had hardly any expansion at all. they have not got out of the cycle of crises and so on. And of course, you've now got unemployment. Officially, it's over 1 million, and for various reasons, it's an underestimate. And there are various estimates that it is, in fact, 1.3 million or 1.5 million. Now, what is the Keynesian's answer to this? You get one Keynesian, Barber, the Minister of Employment, saying on the 23rd of November in the House of Commons that he was puzzled, like other members of the government, that things had not happened as they thought they ought to have happened and as they were told they would happen according to the books. That, and the books, of course, means what they were taught by Keynes. That, in other words, the thing has gone wrong. But belief in Keynes dies hard. They can't give it up because what on earth have they got to put in its place? They're going to find this exceedingly difficult. They've been brought up on Keynes, they've studied Keynes at the universities, they've been running it for 30 years, and you'll get, for example, Victor Feather. I don't suppose Victor Feather really would claim that he knows a great deal about economics. He's just swallowed the stuff from the other people. You'll get Victor Feather for the TUC repeatedly going up to the government and saying, look, we tell you what to do, it's perfectly simple. I heard him in a question and answer programme on the radio last week, and it was really quite pathetic. There was Victor Feather arguing with an employer's representative, both of whom agreed that it's within the power of the government to expand consumption and get rid of unemployment. And all they were disagreed about was whether the government also ought to reduce taxation on company profits. In other words, it was a piffling sort of thing to get involved in. But the argument, whether it comes from Victor Feather or anybody else, is in fact quite baseless, and it doesn't work, and it hasn't worked. So come back to Marx. Now, the fact that Keynes is wrong doesn't itself prove, of course, that Marx was right. And we are not asking you to study Marx merely because Marx was a socialist, so to speak, on our side. Marx was more than a socialist. Marx was a genuine student of capitalism. He spent a lifetime studying capitalism in this country. He wrote about it extensively. And the justification for studying Marx is, A, that he was a genuine student, and that he really did explain it. But in the last resort, it rests with you. We're asking you to read something about Marx and test it yourself as to whether what Marx says does fit the facts of the modern world. And you've got to make the decision. I mean, we're not asking you to take it on merely because we say so, but actually to look at the thing itself. And to complete this introduction, as it were, although almost all of the economists are Keynesians, they have split into various groups, and they're quite disagreed among themselves. They cannot explain why this country has got into the situation in which it has got, or America or Canada and various other countries. They offer all sorts of different explanations, and they cannot agree as to what the government ought to do now. You've only got to read the articles about the state of the country, for example, in the Sunday papers, any Sunday you like. You'll find all sorts of different views being put forward by Keynesians, most of whom still pay tribute to this stuff that has obviously failed. But so much so, of course, that economists generally are getting a bad reputation. And Samuel Britton, who writes for the Financial Times and is himself an economist, wrote about this on the 28th of October last year, a long article, explaining or examining why people no longer trust economists. And actually, it was quite a good article. Britton made this interesting admission about modern economists. He says, modern economists do not exist mainly to promote enlightenment, to discover how the economy works, or for other such vague and worthy purposes. Like all other producers, economists survive and prosper by studying the market and supplying what it appears to want. Well, that needs a bit of explanation. When he talks about the economists as producers, he means they're producers of articles and books and lectures and talks on radio. And what Samuel Britton is saying is they're not genuine students at all, most of them. They're just selling something, and they'll just see what the market wants. And if they happen to be attached to the government, you see, they'll put forward stuff in defence of the government. When the government becomes the opposition and they move out with the Labour Party, the same economists will be putting another point of view. But here you've got Samuel Britton admitting that they are just selling something, and they're selling it for the market, and that they are not genuine students. He went on to contrast modern economists with the early economists. He mentioned Adam Smith and Ricardo, who, he says, were genuinely students of capitalism and were not just trying to sell something. Actually, they didn't make much money anyway out of what they sold, out of what they wrote. He might have added Marx. Marx also was a genuine student. Marx wasn't just writing for the market. In fact, so to speak, when he wrote Capital, there wasn't really a market for it at all. At the beginning, it sold very, very badly. But in any event, he could have included Marx. And you've got this interesting thing that the early economists, like Adam Smith and Ricardo and Marx and a few others, were genuine students of capitalism, and they really did understand and discover things about capitalism. And it is not only not true that the modern economists know more about capitalism merely because they come later, you've actually got this interesting situation that a lot of the basic truths about capitalism discovered by the early economists, Smith, Ricardo and Marx, have been forgotten. You've now got a lot of economists brought up on this new stuff who, as you know very well, if you read their stuff, they will admit now they're baffled. They cannot even understand why things have happened, even when they're writing about them after they've happened, let alone trying to explain what they think will happen in future. But, as I say, this, the justification ultimately is we're asking you to read something about economics and make up your own mind about it. And don't, so to speak, take our word for it, and above all, don't take the word of these other economists about it. You look at it and see if what Marx says really does fit the facts of the situation. Well, Marx wrote a lot of works, Capital, three large volumes, for example. It means a great amount of stuff. It's rather difficult. But what we suggest is that you get hold of two pamphlets, which are not very long, and read these two, which are Wage, Labour and Capital and Value, Price and Profit. Although they're short, they're packed with information, and let's admit it, you've got to give a bit of concentration on it to follow the argument. But nevertheless, they were written either as articles or lectures, and they were intended for quite ordinary people. They weren't written for professionals. And if you give some attention to it, you will be able to follow what the arguments put forward by Marx were. Well, the first of these, Wage, Labour and Capital, has as its subtitle, What Are Wages and How Are They Determined? It was written in 1849. It was revised by Marx's friend Engels in 1891. And some very important corrections of wording were made in it. And before I come on to some of the contents of these two pamphlets, I would offer some words of warning to you, to say to you, in other words, don't be put off by some of the things you're reading these pamphlets. Now, in Wage, Labour and Capital, you will find a reference, for example, to workers being paid 2 shillings a day for 12 hours work, and you'll say, well, you know, this is fantastic. Why pick a little figure like 2 shillings? Well, in actual fact, when this was written, textile workers in the cotton mills in Lancashire were getting 2 shillings for a 12-hour day. They were mainly women and children, and very, very young children at that. But this, in fact, was the rate they were getting. Well, if you want to bring this into modern terms, you have got to multiply it by, I wouldn't like to give a figure or something, but by 20 or 30 times, merely to take account of the depreciation of money. For various reasons, which I'll mention later or at a later lecture, for various reasons, money itself has its purchasing power has been depreciated. So don't think that if people were getting 2 shillings a week for 12 hours work in 1849, I mean, you'll say to yourself, well, how could they live on this? Well, they could live on this at some standard of living, because the things they bought were ever so much cheaper then than they are now. But anyway, don't let it be put off. It doesn't alter the argument. But as I say, when people see this sometimes, they're a bit astonished and don't realise that it can possibly have been based on the facts. If you really want to adjust, to explain why, of course, textile workers in Lancashire are getting very much more pay than this and working shorter hours, you have to remember, as I say, that 2 shillings for 12-hour day was, in effect almost, the wage of children. Well, now, of course, there aren't children employed in textile factories, and there are many more men employed now than there were in 1849. You also got to allow for something else, that in fact the standard of living of the workers, for various reasons, including trade union action, has risen a good deal since 1849. One other thing, when you do come to read it, you have to notice. When Adam Smith and Ricardo wrote about wages, they put forward a theory, which also I'll mention later, that when the worker's wage is what he gets for his labour. Marx came along and made an absolutely radical and vital alteration to this. Marx said the worker is not selling his labour. He doesn't. When you go to work, you're not selling 44 hours of labour to the employer. You are selling your labour power, that's your mental and physical energies. And I'll explain later on why this is so vitally important. But I would mention one thing now. Adam Smith and Ricardo, who, as I say, were genuine students, nevertheless got themselves into an impossible position. They produced a theory that just didn't make sense at all. And Marx went further into it and sorted the thing out. Well, in when Engels did the revision, Engels set out to put labour power wherever, in the first case, Marx used the word labour. Well, he and Marx explained that they did sometimes use the term labour, but it was merely a bit of shorthand. And as he explains in the pamphlet, he's talking about labour power on most of the occasions, but you may come across one or two places where Engels forgot to alter it, and it may lead to a bit of confusion. The other pamphlet, Value, Price and Profit, was a lecture given in 1865 in which Marx dealt with the case put by a friend of his, a man for whom he had a good deal of respect, as a man genuinely interested in working class questions, a man named John Weston. But Marx nevertheless held that Weston was wrong about something. And what Weston was putting forward, and you'll see how very relevant this is to what you know in the 1970s, Weston put forward the argument that it's quite useless for trade unions to press for higher wages. Weston said, all that happens if trade unions press for higher wages, prices go up, and the workers are no better off at the end of it than they were at the beginning, and they might just as well not do it at all, and that therefore trade union action is useless. This was Weston's argument, and Marx dealt with it. One other warning I give you, which applies in fact to both of these pamphlets, and it's something that I have mentioned already. Marx, writing in 1849 and 1865, and Engels, revising it in 1891, assumed a situation in which money was not being depreciated. And all the argument is based on this, although incidentally Marx does, in one place, make a reference to the fact that the value of money itself can change. But the whole of the argument is set out on the basis that the money is not itself depreciated. Well, you see, one of the complicating factors is, for the last 30 years, this government and a number of other governments have been steadily depreciating the purchasing power of money. And if you depreciate the purchasing power of money, one of the main effects is that you induce a continual rise in the price level. And you've got to, when you're reading these two pamphlets, you have to remember this. So you're trying to relate what Marx said then to what's going on now, and you have to keep reminding yourself that the argument Marx laid out was based on a situation where money was not depreciating in value. And here, as I say, it is a complication, but as long as you bear it in mind, I don't think you'll get into any particular difficulty about it. Now, the first and basic thing that Marx dealt with in both of these pamphlets was value and price. But before you begin to understand what value and price are all about, you have to remember that we are living in a capitalist system of society. And here again is something worth noting about Marx. Marx never fell into the error, which so many other economists did, of thinking that you can write economics for all time, that you can write an economic textbook which covers the ancient world and the medieval world and the modern world and the future world. Marx set out, and very, very specifically emphasized it, that he was making a study of capitalism. That's the kind of world in which we live at present. And that what he's saying has no relation, except where he points it out, has no relation to the past or the future. It's simply dealing with capitalism. I would also throw in something else. Marx was not, as some of his critics imagine, though where they got it from I don't know, Marx was never laying down a proposition as to what things ought to be. His purpose in writing about capitalism was to show how it works, what actually happens and why it happens. He wasn't laying down laws or standards for something quite different. As a socialist, of course, he had other views about getting rid of capitalism. But where he was writing on economics, he was telling you what capitalism does, not as he thinks what capitalism ought to be. And you can contrast this with a whole range of economists and businessmen and politicians now who are constantly, week after week, discussing what wages ought to be. They're discussing at the moment what miners' wages ought to be. You get silly loose statement about miners not getting a fair deal and things like this. Well, Marx wasn't concerned with this. Marx was telling you what does happen under capitalism. And I might throw in also, they can discuss till the cows come home what they think wages ought to be, but it won't make much difference, it won't make any difference. In other words, back in 100 years ago, they were discussing what miners' wages ought to be. Now they come along 100 years later, and they say, good Lord, miners are getting these wages. There must be something wrong. But while the strike's on, they'll go on talking like this, and when the strike's over, of course, they'll forget all about it, and they'll move on to some other body of workers, about what some other workers ought to get. And as I say, this shows the weakness of their position as compared with the position of Marx, because Marx did explain, as I say, what does happen and why wages are what they are. But he was dealing with capitalism. And you've got to remember what capitalism is. It's got, shall we say, five main features. That it is a class-divided society. It's quite useless talking about the community and things like this. It is not a community. There are 55 million people in this country, but it's not a community. It's a class-divided society. On the one hand, you have a property-owning and employing class, and on the other side, you have a essentially non-property-owning class, a working class. And by property-owning, the essential fact about property-owning is that the property-owning class, the capitalists, own the means of production, the land, factories, transport, buildings, and so on. I'm not going to spend any time at the moment dealing with what may appear to be a contradiction to this, that we've now got things called nationalized industries. This is really quite irrelevant, but I won't worry about it at the moment. The fact is that the capitalist class own the means of production of, in this country, the land, factories, means of transport, buildings, and the rest of it. And this owning class receives property income. It receives an income by owning property. It receives rent, interest, and profit. The working class is the producing class. It's the working class who do all the work of society. I mean, it's quite true, some of the capitalists do some work too, but it's the working class who carry all the burden of this, do all the work, and they get for this wages or salaries paid to them by the owners as employers, to the workers as employees. So I say it is a class-divided society. And the other thing to notice in particular, because people, it's an obvious thing, but people often forget it, although the working class do the work of production and transport and all the rest of it, the products of industry do not belong to the working class who produce them. They belong to the owning class and are sold by the owning class in order to get a profit. These are the five basic features of the world in which you live. Now, if you want to understand how capitalism operates, you want to know what determines the amount of wages, the amount of profits, the level of prices, and the amount of employment and unemployment. These are some, at least, of the main things that, as workers, you want to understand. Now, some people have a belief that you don't need to study economics to get the answer to these things. Without ever being consciously putting forward this theory, nevertheless, a very large part of the population believe it to be true. They believe that you don't need to study economics, because all you have to do is to look at the will of the people concerned. They will say, for example, that prices and profits are determined by the sellers. When prices go up, they will say, look, it's the retailers, it's the manufacturers, they've done this, they've just willed prices to go up. And they will say, according to their bias, some of them will say that wages are determined by the trade unions, that what the level of wages is what the trade unions want them to be. And of course, you'll find some other people who flatly contradict this and say that wages are what the employers want them to be. Well, Marx did one very, very useful thing, which is vital to his study of economics, to say that these simple beliefs are so largely untrue that they're really quite irrelevant. That prices, wages, profits are the outcome of various forces which operate according to economic laws, the economic laws of capitalism. And if you want to know why prices are at the level they are, why they sometimes go up and sometimes go down, and why wages are what they are and why profits are what they are, you've got to understand how capitalism works, because these are the outcome of various forces and they operate in accordance with various laws. Now, the basic concept of Marxian economics is value. And you've got to, you use the term value yourself, but you've got to be a bit careful here. Economically, it's got a defined meaning, which is not always or necessarily the same as the meaning in everyday language. Everybody knows and accepts that different articles sell at different prices. You know, for example, that motorbikes, however the price of motorbikes may fluctuate or go up or go down or anything like this, you know that motorbikes always sell at a higher price than a pedal cycle. And you know that, if you look at it, that an ounce of gold always sells for more than an ounce of silver. And that, take a rough example, a table, you would always expect a table to cost more than a chair. And you expect an overcoat to cost more than a jacket. Well, Marx came along and said that the basic underlying explanation of this is that different products have different values, and their values correspond to the amount of labour required to produce them. if, for example, on average it takes 20 hours of labour to make one article and 10 hours of labour to make another, then the first one will have a value which will be twice as much as the value of the other. If, for example, it takes 20 hours labour to make a motorcycle and only 10 hours to make a pedal cycle, then you would say that the motorcycle has a value twice as great as a pedal cycle, and you're at least halfway to understanding why the price of a motorcycle is always more than that of a pedal cycle. Now, as I put it like this, if you think about it, you'll see, oh, well, there are some holes in this. So you have to remember that it's not just how much labour happens to be spent on producing a thing, but how much labour it is necessary to spend on it. In other words, if you happen to be dealing with a product produced by some very unskilled and very inefficient worker or company, if they choose or have to spend a lot more labour on producing something than the average which is necessary under modern conditions, then that labour is wasted. So what Marx is saying is, with regard to all articles, he calls them commodities, it just means an article for sale, but the value of all kinds of commodities, it depends on the amount of labour socially necessary to produce them. Meaning that at a given time and in a given place, with a given general level of technical efficiency, because, as you know, the technical efficiency of production is constantly changing, improving, that with a given level of efficiency, you can get a concept of the average amount of labour necessarily used up in producing a certain article. And amount of labour means a number of hours of labour. And one other qualification is to remember that skilled labour counts correspondingly more than unskilled labour. Now, if you get this conception that every article on sale, every commodity, is a product of the working class and has a value according to the amount of labour socially necessary to produce it, you then want to say to yourself, well, where does price come into this? Because in fact, of course, you don't know anything about the value of commodities. All you know is how much you have to pay for them when you go into a shop to buy them. And the first thing is to recognise that the prices of individual articles do not necessarily coincide with the value. There are always day-to-day fluctuations. Prices can go up. If there happens to be a sudden new demand for something, the price will go up. If there happens to be a big increase in the production of something for some reason or other, the price will go down. I mean, you see this best in agriculture. If you happen to have a very good crop one year, the price of wheat will in fact fall. If you have a very bad crop, the price of wheat will rise. And this is a mixture of two things. One, so to speak, it's a fluctuation, but also in the year of a bad crop, it does in fact cost more labour to produce a ton of wheat than in a year when the crop is good. But you've got two things. You've got changes in the amount of labour required, but also you have day-to-day fluctuations in the price. Now, one of the things you'll find set out in these pamphlets is Marx warns you against thinking that you merely need look at the price of an article today to know, get some idea of its value. I said to you before that Marx laid out and explained that capitalism goes through this cycle of expansion, boom, crisis, depression. Well, if you get out of your minds the last 30 years when the value of money has been depreciating all the time and so all prices have been going up, and if you were to go back to the 19th century, in a boom prices rise, and in a depression they fall. They don't fall very much, and they don't rise very much. So this sort of thing is going on, and what Marx was saying is, if you want to get an idea of the value of a commodity, you must take it on an average over a few years to cover this rise of the price due to the boom and the fall of the price due to the depression. And if you you may have the impression, of course, that in the modern world nothing ever goes down in price. Well, though you may not notice it, this isn't true. If you were to take some of the metals, I'm only going to take one of them at the moment, the price of copper in 1970 rose to £700 a tonne. In 1971 it was down to £400 a tonne. It's exceedingly likely the copper experts expect it'll go up to £700 a tonne in 1972 when demand recovers. But if you want to apply Marx's notion of value and price, you will say the average of £700 and £400 is £550. So that if you look at the price of copper over two or three years, or over a whole cycle, you don't take the top figure or the bottom figure, you take an average which you might say, well, £550 a tonne is the sort of figure that represents the real value of copper in relation to the amount of labour required to produce it. I'll keep reminding you of this depreciation of money, because as I say, otherwise if you don't remember it and if you don't understand it, you'll find it very confusing. But as I say, governments in this country for 30 years have been depreciating the value of money, so that whatever else may be happening, there's been a tendency for prices to go on rising. And if you want to get a picture of what's really going on, you know that a pound has 16 ounces. Suppose, and this is fixed by law, in other words, a retailer can't sell you a pound of potatoes and only give you 8 ounces for it. But suppose the law were taken away, and suppose that the retailer could fix his own number of ounces to the pound. And suppose you bought a pound of potatoes last week for 5 new pence and got 16 ounces. And suppose you go back to the retailer this week and he doesn't let you know, or he may even let you know, he may say, well, my pound in future is only going to have 8 ounces. Well, it would appear to you that you're now getting a pound of potatoes for 2.5 pence. You'll think, well, the price has gone down. But it hasn't, of course, hasn't changed at all. In this case, you're only getting 8 ounces instead of 16. Well, this is an analogy of what has been happening to money, that you think the pound note doesn't change, but in spite of Harold Wilson's famous statement that time of devaluation that the value of the pound in your pocket doesn't change. You may think, well, the pound note always looks the same, but in fact, because of something the governments have been doing, the purchasing power of the pound has been more or less steadily going down for the last 30 years. And I say you merely have to remember this when you're looking at the arguments and the examples given in these two pamphlets. Now, the next important thing to remember, and I suppose the average worker would be staggered to be told this, that wages also are prices. The worker doesn't think of wages as a price. The worker thinks of prices as only meaning the other things, the things he buys. He doesn't think that wages also are a price. Well, it was Marx's great contribution to economic study to show that wages are the price of what the worker sells. The worker hasn't got any commodities to sell, he hasn't got any potatoes or cotton or motor cars to sell, because they don't belong to him, they belong to the employer. What the worker has got is his labour power, his mental and physical energy. When you go to an employer and you say he gives you a job and you expect you to do 44 hours for 30 quid or whatever it is for a week, what he's buying from you is the disposal of your mental and physical energy. He buys your energy. He's not buying your 44 hours work, he's buying your energy. In other words, Marx showed that labour power is a commodity, just like chairs and tables and tons of wheat and bales of cotton and all the rest of it, and that being a commodity, it has a value and a price just like other commodities. And he shows that, like other commodities, the value of labour power is determined by the number of hours labour needed to produce it. Now, when workers first read this, they find it very confusing. They will read that the value of a motorbike is reckoned by the fact that it needs 20 hours labour to produce it. When they're told that the worker's labour power has a value which is also the number of hours taken to produce it, it looks on the face of it quite confusing. What is the labour needed to produce labour power? Well, the labour needed to produce labour power is the number of hours labour necessary to produce the worker's living standard, his food, clothing, shelter, and the rest of it. And this is, in fact, what is happening. This value of labour power, that's the number of hours labour required to produce his food and his clothing and his shelter and all the rest of it, it can vary in different places, in different occupations, and in different times. But nevertheless, it is a steady concept. And once you get this concept in your mind and can see the changes that happen, you will understand, for example, if prices generally go up and other things remaining unchanged, wages will go up, because the money required to buy the food, clothing and shelter itself becomes greater. In other words, if prices double, in order to maintain the same standard of living, a worker's wage would have to go up from £20 to £40 a week in order to buy just the same quantities of food, clothing and shelter that he bought before. Now, just to take an illustration, take a factory worker getting £30 for a 44-hour week. The things he buys with his £30 take only about, say, 22 hours. I mean, these are in just rough example. That he works for 44 hours, but he gets a wage which really only represents 22 hours, because it only takes 22 hours to produce his food, clothing and shelter. And which means, in the Marxian conception, that when the employer buys labour power and then puts it to work, he's getting unpaid labour. He is, in fact, buying, on my example, he is, in fact, paying the equivalent of 22 hours work, 22 hours labour, but he's getting 44 hours out of it. In other words, he's getting 22 hours for nothing. And to go back into history may, in fact, help you to understand this. Before capitalism came along, when serfdom was the normal way in which things were carried on, the serf used to work 3 days a week on his own land. And he was producing stuff for himself and knew what he was doing. The other 3 days a week he spent on the land of the lord of the manor, and he wasn't paid for doing it. He spent 3 hours, 3 days a week for nothing. In other words, he knew quite well that he was working 6 days, but 3 days he was producing stuff for himself, and the other 3 days he was producing for the lord of the manor. Well, the only real difference that capitalism has made in now is that the capitalist now gives the worker money for doing this. But it hasn't altered the fact that the worker's still doing, as it were, 3 days a week of work for nothing. But the worker, the capitalist now pays the worker, in effect, for his mental and physical energies for a week. But he's really only paying him for 3 days. And the capitalist, who's replaced the lord of the manor, is now getting 3 days' labour for nothing. One thing other to remember, wages don't have to be the bare physical minimum required to keep a worker alive, and generally speaking they are not. There are some cases, some times and places where the worker's driven down really to the bare physical minimum or even below it. But the wages do not have to be like that, and Marx showed historically that unlike cotton and tables and things like this, there is what Marx called a historical and moral element enters into wages. That, for example, if the workers have been used for a long time to having a certain standard of living, it's very difficult, if not absolutely impossible, for the capitalist to take it away from them. And this enters into their standard of living, and so to speak, the things that are an absolute necessity to the worker in 1972 may not have been necessary to the worker in 1900, but they've now entered into the value of the worker's labour power. And on this basis, of course, Marx argued that trade unions and workers' organisation and struggle themselves play a part. That there is one great difference between the labour power commodity and the other commodities. The other commodities are inanimate objects. Cotton can't struggle for itself, but the workers can struggle for themselves, and what struggle the workers carry on against the employer in order to get higher wages or resist a reduction does play a part. Come back to one thing that I mentioned earlier, that the value of commodity depends on the amount of hours of labour necessary to produce it. But one thing you have to remember, and all the non-Marxian economists, or almost all of them, completely fail to notice this or understand it, and they get into great confusion. The labour required to produce a commodity is the labour required to produce a commodity from the very first stage to the very last stage. In other words, the amount of labour required to produce coal isn't just the labour of miners in the mines, it includes the labour of electricians, the labour of engineers in the engineering industry who produce mining machinery, and the labour of the miners who produce the iron ore and the smelters and all the rest of it, and the transport workers. That even if it's not particularly easy, of course, to work out what is the total amount of labour required to produce commodities, you've got to remember that it's the whole of the labour that counts, right from the beginning, cover the whole process. In other words, it's no use looking merely at one last process and thinking that the labour in the last process is the labour required to produce the commodity. It's got to be the whole lot. And as I say, it's misled a lot of economists and newspaper writers and so on, who are constantly getting themselves in a tangle. They will come along and they will announce some new, more productive machine has been introduced to cover a certain part of the operation of production, and they will say, you know, this represents a terrific increase in productivity. Well, of course, it doesn't. It only represents an increase in productivity in that particular limited sphere where it operates. But if you want to consider the effect on the production of the commodity itself, you've got to relate it to the whole extent of production from the beginning to end. Or to give you an example, some years ago, the head of the Volkswagen company, they had announced the introduction of certain automated processes for a certain stage in the manufacture of motor cars. And he did understand what he was doing. And he was giving a lecture about it, and he said, you want to remember, if I can get an automated process which cuts by 50% the amount of labour required, shall we say, in assembling cars. He said this doesn't represent a 50% cheapening in the production of cars. It in fact only represents a cheapening of about 5%, because this automated process is only operating in perhaps 1/20th of the whole of the operations required to produce a car. As I say, the Marxian view puts this in proper perspective, and the others don't. The next stage in this is, I refer to the capitalist getting unpaid labour, which in fact he does. Well, in Marxian conception, this is called surplus value. Where the serf was operating, it wasn't surplus value, it was surplus product. The serf producing for working 3 days for the manorial lord, you couldn't call it surplus value because he wasn't paid for it. But he was, in fact, literally producing surplus product which the lord of the manor took away and consumed. Well, in capitalism, this unpaid labour represents the surplus value that the whole of the capitalist class gets. And it is out of surplus value that rent, interest and profit come. And one other warning that you have to bear in mind to get this thing in proper perspective, it is not really accurate to think of the individual worker in the individual factory producing surplus value. In the Marxist conception, it's a rather more complicated thing, but in the Marxist conception, you have to think of the whole of the working class engaged in production are producing a massive surplus value, and that this is in fact divided up in various ways over to the different capitalists in relation to the amount of their capital. That is a complication. I merely mention it. You needn't worry about it particularly while you're leading these two pamphlets. Now, when you come to the second pamphlet, and Marx's friend John Weston, I said that the argument Weston put up was trade unions are useless because if workers put up wages, prices go up. And as I say, this is right up to date. You can hear it every week almost. You'll hear somebody saying, in fact, you'll find the government themselves saying so. The only way to stop prices going up is to stop wages going up. And funnily enough, one of the dissenting voices in the Conservative Party is Enoch Powell, who says it's all nonsense. And Enoch Powell says, of course, prices go up because, I mean, he says, because the government's depreciating the money. And you can't, this is the government's responsibility, not the workers. But look at the thing seriously. See, that a lot of workers believe this. A lot of workers believe that when they get higher wages, this automatically means higher prices. And in a time when the government's depreciating the currency, it may look like it, because if everything's constantly going up, see, it's quite easy to say that one thing is the cause of the other. But in other words, one lot of people will say prices go up because wages go up. But of course, another lot of people, I mean, the trade unions will say, quite untrue, it's the other way around, that wages go up because prices go up. But there are still other people who use a different argument. There's one lot of people who argue, retailers and manufacturers, that the real cause of putting up prices of everything is that the cost of transport goes up. Every time the railways put up their prices, or the road haulage people put up their prices, you'll get howls of protest from manufacturers and retailers and passengers on railways and saying, look, the real cause of prices going up is that transport's gone up. Or equally, of course, they'll say that when postal rates go up or telephone charges go up, they'll say, look, this is going to put up the price of everything. Well, you really want to forget all these arguments. And remember that in the 19th century, or at any time when the government wasn't depreciating the currency, John Weston's argument wouldn't have looked nearly as strong as it was. Because at a time when currency isn't depreciating, and therefore there isn't a general rise in prices, the prices are more or less stable, it's not so easy for even for John Weston to come along and say, if you put up wages, employers will put up prices. Because, as Marx pointed out, what do you think that sellers of commodities do, retailers and manufacturers? Do you think that they reach, they look at their cost of production and say, well, look, I can sell this article for £10, so I'll only sell it for £10. No, on the contrary. Doesn't matter how much it costs them, if they can sell that article for £15, they'll sell it for £15. They'll sell it for whatever the market will bear. And even bringing it up to date now, even in this present time when currency is depreciated and money's going up, I just read you a list of some of the prices which fell last year. I mentioned copper, which fell by 40%, from £700 to £417 a tonne, antimony, which fell from £1,130 to £560, platinum from £51.5 to £46.5, zinc Zinc went up. Wheat last year fell from £34.10 to £31. Cocoa fell from £311 to £202. Copper fell from $223 to $166. Silver fell from 67 new pence an ounce to 51 pence. Now, if some people argue, as they do, that it is wages going up that put up prices, they then have to say, why did all these mining companies producing all these things reduce their prices? You can take some cases. In the case of the copper, wages were going up while prices were going down. And the answer is that the copper people and the antimony and zinc and all the rest of them sell their stuff for what the market will bear. Well, last year, for various reasons, one, incidentally, was the slackening of the Vietnam War, the demand, but generally the decline in activity in factories. A lot of factories use copper, for example, for a lot of things. There was a declining demand for copper, and there was nothing on earth the sellers of copper could do to keep the price of copper up. In other words, they're selling their copper for what the market will bear, and no matter whether wages were going up or going down, and actually wages were going up, these mining companies were unable to get their former price for what they were selling. Their price had to come down. So as I say, in the 19th century, Marx could give a lot of examples to Weston to show that Weston was wrong, that in fact it didn't even look as if prices just went up because wages went up. But the argument, which you want to go through carefully, is rather more elaborate than this. Marx argued, in the first place, that the sellers of commodities always sell them for as much as the market will bear. If, therefore, they're faced with an effective demand for wages, after all, no, wages don't go up just because the workers ask for it, but if the workers happen to be in a relatively strong position and can press for higher wages and get higher wages, as Marx pointed out, in the first place, this comes out of the employer's profits. If it didn't come out of the employer's profits, why do employers resist demands for higher wages? Why don't employers generally say, well, look, we can always pass it on, we'll just give wages? Even in times of boom, employers will try to resist wage increases. But anyway, Marx said, employers always charge what the market will bear. So that if they are compelled to put up wages, in the short term, profits are going to suffer. Their profits are going to come down. Of course, they put up their wages. But also in the short term, and Marx used this sort of argument, if wages go up at the expense of profits, you've got the employing class having its income reduced, working class who've got more wages having their income increased. And as Marx said, the effect of this will be that those in the short term, those things that the worker buys, there'll be a bigger demand for them and the price will in fact go up. But simultaneously, the things that the capitalists used to buy, the luxuries, the Rolls Royces and so on that he used to buy and can't buy any longer because his income's reduced, those will come down. So in the short term, you get two movements. One lot of prices go up, the other lot of prices come down. Well, then, as Marx pointed out, if prices go up in a certain field, it will mean that those capitalists in that field are selling more, and therefore, generally, we can assume they're making more profit, so that capital will no longer flow into the luxury industries, it'll flow into these other industries. In other words, more capitalists will move into producing these articles for working class consumption. That's in the short term. In the long term, this adjusts itself, because as more manufacturers move into producing things, the price comes down again. This short-term rise in prices is altered, it comes down again. And similarly, as regards the luxury goods, if capital moves out, this gives an opportunity for profits to rise again in that industry. But that in the long term, and not too long a term, I mean in the longish term, the thing will adjust itself, and the result of a general increase in wages will be that the workers are better off and that the capitalists are worse off. But then, of course, you have to remember, we're dealing with capitalism. And as the capitalist only goes into production in order to make profit, if, in fact, the rate of profit is falling, the capitalist will do less investment. This is, of course, what the government and the Tory Party and the Labour Party are all complaining, the TUC are all complaining about at the present time. They can't get the capitalists to invest in expanding their factories, and the reason the capitalists are not doing it is because the rate of profit has fallen. It's not attractive. Financial Times today published, as they do every 3 months, I think it is, or every month, they go round to employers and ask them, look, do you think your prospects are? Do you think that your rate of profit is going to rise or fall? And they analyse the results, and they're awfully pleased this morning to report that there's been a slight increase in the number of capitalists who at the present moment, on present price levels and wage levels, think that their rate of profit is going to rise in the coming year. Now, you see, if enough capitalists think that their rate of profit is going to rise in the coming year, they will then start reinvesting. They will start expanding production, building new factories and so on. So remember, of course, for Marx there is no real long term, because capitalism will always go through this cycle of expansion, crisis, contraction, depression and so on, and this will go on and on. But just to remind you of this, the essential part about all of this is that Marx is saying that things do not happen just because capitalists or workers or retailers or manufacturers or anybody else wants them to. That the thing follows a pattern, which is the economic laws of capitalism, and what happens can always be explained in these terms, and that you've got to get away from the idea that you merely have to ask yourself what somebody wants, because what somebody wants isn't going to have much effect against the real facts of the capitalist world, and that in fact the capitalists cannot themselves put up prices just because they want to put up prices, as shown by the examples I gave you, where these quite big industries have had to put their prices down. They couldn't do anything else. Marx also pointed out, by the way, in reply to Weston, you see, if you accepted Weston's argument that putting up wages puts up prices, as Marx said to Weston, look at the country at that time, 1865, and of course it's still true, look at America, where wages are much higher than they were in Britain. Marx said to Weston, if what you're saying is true, prices ought to be higher in America. Well, in that time they were not. There were a whole lot of industries in America where, in spite of higher wages, the things they were selling were cheaper than they were in this country. It isn't quite so true now for various other reasons, but the basic validity of the argument still remains. This thing I've mentioned about depreciation of currency, I've warned you several times about it, bear it in mind, but I shall be dealing with it later on in a talk on why prices go up. One other last thing. Marx, of course, was, as I say, was a genuine student of capitalism. His being a socialist was something that he reached out of this. Marx was not, like the Keynesians and others, saying to you, look, I understand capitalism, I can explain to the government how to run capitalism. From Marx's point of view, there are no ways of running capitalism except the way it normally operates. In other words, Marx wouldn't have agreed with Victor Feather or Harold Wilson or Barber or all the rest of it, that if you do certain things you can make capitalism operate differently. Marx said you can't. The capitalism operates like this, and except within very, very narrow limits, there is nothing you can do. It is a comprehensive system which works according to certain laws, and if you do start mucking about with it and think, well, I can isolate this bit and make a change here, you'll only upset something else. I mean, this would have been Marx's view. But right at the end of the second pamphlet, The Value, Price and Profit, Marx discusses what trade unions can do. He shows that there are only limited things that a trade union can do. I mean, and this is one of the tragedies of the trade union movement, that a lot of the members of trade unions want the trade unions to do something which it is not in their power to do. And this, of course, can lead to all sorts of tragic events in trade union history. But Marx ended up by saying to the workers, stop the trade union, stop having on your banner the slogan, a fair day's wage for a fair day's work. I mean, to Marx this was all nonsense, and there isn't such a thing. And he said, adopt instead the abolition of the wages system. For Marx, it's not a question of looking for trying to make capitalism work so that to meet Victor Feather's point of view, or the miner's point of view, you have fair wages, which is, of course, a piece of nonsense. Marx said, get rid of capitalism, abolish the wages system, the price system, all the rest of it, property incomes, and have socialism. But this is another thing. And it's a very sad thought. I saw pictures of the miners' demonstration in London yesterday. To see miners now, in this year, carrying banners, give us a living wage. In other words, if the miners were to read value, price and profit and take in Marx's argument, they would realise that this sort of thing, give us a living wage, is just as meaningless as the fair day's wage for fair day's wage for a fair day's work. I mean, from Marx's point of view, this is nonsense. And it's our job is, of course, to try to get the workers to recognise what capitalism is and to know that there aren't any ways of making capitalism essentially different from what it has always been.
Thank you. Before we start on the next part, which is your part, by the way, we're going to have questions and discussion, and I hope it'll be questions for a bit, because there's plenty of us, and I'm glad to see you've got a lot of visitors, who I'll give preference to wherever possible. But I would ask you for a collection to help us defray our expenses. Unfortunately, we haven't socialism yet, and we do have to pay our way, and we can only do it with your help. Those of you
in the same place, by which he meant was that however much they could improve output by new machinery, this was more than offset by the fact that the mines get deeper and deeper. And that, by the way, is true of most minerals, copper, zinc, silver, gold, and so on. For the same reason, it becomes more and more costly in terms of labour to produce a given quantity of them. Now, another reason why prices can change, that you're all fairly familiar with, is government subsidies. When the Second World War broke out, it becomes more and more costly in terms of labour to produce a given quantity of them. Now, another reason why prices can change, that you're all fairly familiar with, is government subsidies. When the Second World War broke out, as the government policy was to keep down the prices of certain articles, the reason was a fairly obvious one. They wanted to discourage strikes and demands for higher wages. So a policy was introduced of subsidising certain articles of food. So ever since then, although it's coming to an end now, ever since then they have spent hundreds of millions of pounds in effect paying farmers to put food products on the market at below their economic price. So you can get government subsidies which can sell goods at an artificially low price. And on the in the opposite direction, monopoly will put up price. If the manufacturer of some article has a monopoly of it, as can happen sometimes when a new article is coming into the market, he's in a position to charge a price which has no relation to value. Monopolies in general don't last long, because obviously if a monopolist is in a position to charge a very high price, one of the effects is he'll make a very large profit. Well, if there's a very large profit to be made in the manufacture of certain things, very soon other people will move in. New capital.